Well, good morning and welcome. Well, good morning and welcome to Take a Lesson, the national conversation on our community. My name is Ed Harris, principal consultant at Altruistic Leadership, gospel recording artist, and I'm a senior pastor. Today we also have with us Annalisa Adams-Quartier, founder and principal of Altruistic Leadership, where our vision, mission, and purpose is providing outstanding educational resource for diverse leaders. Blakeland Morris is also with us today. He's the co-founder of the African American Leadership Program. We call it AALP. And together with me and Annalisa and Monica, we had a good time putting that program together and working it through. Blake has 35 years of insurance experience and has been in management for 25 years. Today we have the pleasure of having our speaker and moderator be for this national conversation be Monica Brooks. And Monica is a community member and advocate for literacy, racial diversity, and autism awareness in the San Francisco Bay Area. She's a founder of Great Books for Our Kids, which is a community a community organization that promotes literacy and education through interactive community building. She also is the executive director of the MOCA Autism Network, in which she works to spread awareness of autism within communities of color. Monica, how you doing today?
Good morning. Happy July. It's a beautiful day in the Bay Area as soon as it becomes daytime.
You're right. It's a little early, isn't it? And I hear Annalisa and Blake back there in the background. How you guys? How you doing this morning?
Good morning, Ed. How are you?
All right.
Good morning, Ed. Thank you for opening up for us today.
Thanks for that. It's a pleasure. We also want to thank and welcome our guests from the African American Leadership Program LinkedIn group. This series is actually directed by request from over 13,000 members of that group. And we also want to take this time publicly to thank you for asking for this national conversation. So today, we really want to try to jump in and let me kind of do something, set the table for our topic of discussion today in regard to this situation. Monica's going to take us through key attitudes and actions and answers around questions being asked on our colleges and at our university campuses. Questions like, do U.S. colleges have a race problem? The changing face of the historical black colleges and universities, when we talk about that, what does that demographic shift mean? What's going on there? Classroom culture at HBCUs is something else that came up as something that we want to talk about today. What's happening with the student activists as an active agent for change on their own destiny, and even more questions as we come out. We want to remind you that you do get a chance to call in. Please use the chat feature as well, and we'll bring your questions into the conversation. You can call us at 215-383-3697 and follow the prompts to join the conversation. So without further ado, let me go ahead and turn this conversation and discussion over to our Monica Brooks, and she'll be able to set us straight on a lot of things, get us on the right path, and help us out with some things that are going on. All right, Monica, you ready?
Sure, no pressure. Got it.
No pressure at all. Jump right in when you feel like it.
Okay, so I'm here to talk about the colleges and university structure of the Black Lives Matter and any other social justice movement, but I also would like to speak out on the fact that we are now going younger with our activism. So we must start talking about the high school process, the first signs of independence of high school students, you know, and their need for social justice. In the Bay Area, in a lot of occasions, our students tend to protest a lot because it's what we do. It's good in some ways because it's showing activism, it's showing an awareness of the news and events happening and affecting them long term. One of the challenges is when we talk about activism, we don't bring young people to the table. So one of the things that we need to do when we start talking about the concept of bringing people to the table and talking about social justice, we must bring in the people who are in the streets. We must talk about how we go into high schools and we must teach effective social justice and effective, you know, evaluation and critical thinking of news sources and news events, so that we create a more effective and sustainable activist population. So as what I also do when I'm not fighting crime is I also speak to high school students about effective protests. And the reason why I do that is because, number one, they let me, because, you know, high school students don't like to let you do anything. And number two, we need to show our young people that we believe in their energy and we need to redirect it in a way that is effective and makes a difference in the world. So the populations of people who are protesting now are usually younger, as always. As we know, John Lewis, when he fought, was, you know, a 21-year-old man. So college students fighting for justice is not a shock. So far, there have been campuses who not only work for Black Lives Matter in the realm of social justice on the side of the judicial and police systems, but also social justice in the educational scheme, in the tenure of professors, in the diversity of administrations, in the elimination of microaggressions on college campuses. There are over 85 campuses in the United States and Canada that have public statements and a list of demands for their campuses. And that includes all of them in the Bay Area by Black students. This creates a need for administrations to do something. And because we need to, because as we know, just like the police system, just like, you know, regular life, the system was not created with African Americans or any other people of color in mind in its creation, and very little has changed in the structure and bureaucracy of college campuses.
So, Monica,
so,
can I jump in for
yes,
a second
sir.
While you're right,
yes,
while you're sir. Right there, because a question came in, and I think maybe you can tie it in just a little bit. When you speak talking about not being created for people of color, there was a question that came in from an AALP person. They wanted to know, how do you, and you can work this into your statement if you can, how do you talk about race without offending people? Because one of the questions comes up is, if it was created without people of color in mind, then you got to talk about it at some point. And how do you do that without offending people? And I just wanted to throw that in real fast. I don't want to throw you off, but it was
something
there that came up.
Because it's so funny, I didn't have a statement. That was freestyle, so it's cool. Here's the thing. If we're dealing with the system, there's two trains of thought, and better people think way better than I do, but here's a train of thought. If you are dealing with the system without you in mind, why are you the one accused of being offended? That's one thing. And I understand that there are hurt feelings, but the system is not here for you in mind. So anything that you do outside of the current system is going to offend someone because of the way the system is set up.
That makes sense. And the second point on that was what?
And what was the second question? I'm sorry, I think I lost it.
Well, you were saying there were two trains of thought. So that was
the second thought is you casually go in, you try to explain nicely. And sometimes that doesn't even work because microaggressions allows the privileged class to assume that you're doing harm to them regardless of the tone. So what happens is what we're teaching college students, and I'm an advisor to Black organizations on the campus that I work at, is I tell them going on the street is fine. However, you need to create an effective way, not only through your voice, but through the actions of your organizations to train other people around you to build coalitions. So if there's, you know, we had on our campus, we had an event for Black Lives Matter. It was a safe space. in which we invited the officers of color, because some of the officers of color, although they are officers, they get stopped on the way home too.
Right.
So what we do is we let our students hear those stories, because that helps them understand that the system is bigger than the campus and or the people around them. So we had our chief of police is a woman, a black woman, and she says, not only am I the chief of police on this campus, but I have a son your age. That helps create a different conversation. Unfortunately, that is what community policing is, and in this current institutional system, there's no money in that. And that's why a lot of these conversations aren't done.
Okay, super. I get it.
So one thing that I do want to talk about is the actions of college students on campus to promote a intersectional look at how universities are operated has never changed. In 1966, the establishment of the first Black Studies program was created, and then it was shut down, and then a strike happened in 1968, and then the establishment of the first Black Studies department was created in 1969 at San Francisco State University. Things have not changed. Whenever things are happening that will change the institution to make it look like what America looks like, there are people in departments, in the streets, in boardrooms, in Congress, trying to make these things happen. Now, our college students and our high school students in extension are the reason why a lot of these things happen. We can say that it's, the older and the elder. We can say all that, but it's really not true. The truth is, anything we do, it's for the people who come after us. The people who come after us are our high school and college students. And they set the pace for how we help make social justice happen in this country. So on college campuses, there have been strikes. There was one at University of Missouri, MISU. It was called Concerned Student 1950. Concerned Student 1950 was rooted in the student who was the first African-American student on that campus in 1950. They had a hunger strike to create better diversity, mental health places, a bigger recruitment of African-American students, because Black Lives Matter means you have to make sure that Black Lives Matter wherever you are in any institution, including the institution of education. So things like that have been happening since African-Americans have been on campus. So when we talk about things like how are we going to get students involved, they are already involved. We just have to provide them as mentors and as quote-unquote adultier adults. We have to inform them on how to critically think the news that is being given to them and figure out a way to teach them to fight the battles that they feel are the most important and that they serve their people and make their people proud.
Monica, why are you taking a breath there? Stacy's from Virginia, and she's 20 years old. And Stacy says she really likes your energy, first of all. And the second thing she says is that you're right that youth activism is rising, but it's not without its critics. And she makes the point that adults are unable to view young people as their equal partners in making decisions. How would you suggest that we address this?
Well, first let's understand that in all the criticism, mostly rooted towards, Martin Luther King wouldn't do that. We must understand that when Martin Luther King was around, they didn't like him either. Because people older than Martin Luther King thought that Martin Luther King was doing too much. What is he doing in these streets? We need to, the same argument that is happening to the Black Lives Matter young people happened when Martin Luther King and Malcolm X came. They happened to Marcus Garvey. They happen, it happens to everyone. It's generational, and the sad thing is, my generation, I'm post-King. I was born after Martin Luther King was assassinated. Our generation didn't have, like, a movement. We didn't have the technology to do the things that the young people are doing now, although we had the same problems. In 1988, Yusuf Hawkins was killed in New York by police. So we've had these same problems. And one of the things that us older people need to do is we literally need to listen to the young people speaking, because they're saying the exact same thing we did. It's kind of like hip-hop. Elders can't stand hip-hop. They don't know what they're doing. It's just, it's like the same generational argument that we have with everything, that, you know, because they want us, they want young people to be safe. And a lot of elders think that they do all these things to make you safe. And now the young people are like, yeah, but that didn't work. So now what we can do instead of, and this is on us, it's not on the young people, because the young people only know what their experience brings them, and their experience doesn't bring them as much as we do. So we need to listen to the young people as they are speaking and as they are showing their frustration, because they show their frustration to somebody older before they get in the street. And we have to let them know, well, how do you feel about that? These are the risks of doing things. You know, I had a friend who had a daughter who protested at Berkeley High because there was a threatening email. And I said, well, call your mom and then put my phone number on your wrist in case the police come, because I work around the corner. And then I said, why are you out there? Do you know why you're out there? And then if they know, then you say, okay, always use your own theories of criticism to this argument. Because our job as people who are older than the young people protesting is to help guide them in their frustration. It's not to stop them. It's only to make sure that what they're doing is right, they understand consequences, and they are, like I said, they do right by their people, and they make us proud. That's our job. So if they're protesting, our job is to let them do that. And especially as parents of color, we don't really let our kids do much. And I think that's a lot of it, because we only allow our kids to do what we tell them. So when they do things like this, it's like we get frustrated. But our job is literally to allow them the critical thinking skills to know what is worth fighting for.
You know, Monica, you are absolutely right. And as we're having this conversation, we're finding that young people all over the country are signing in. Nathan is in Georgia. He's 19 years old. And his statement, tell Nathan, hey. So his statement is, structural racism is our educational system. Now that's a mouthful right there. How are we being in conversations with our administration when addressing race, which is part of our impacts our grade, especially if you're not open or you're not on an HBCU. So what I think he's saying is that structural racism is embedded in our education system. And so how do you address the administration when you're talking about race if you're not on an HBCU and it's a predominantly privileged society campus? So, Blake, Annalisa, if you guys are out there, you can jump in on this too.
I would argue that it would be harder to talk about race at a HBCU than it would be at a predominantly white institution. And I'm saying that because HBCUs were the last to get ethnic studies classes, because the belief was that we're already black, we don't need black studies. So there's that. If everyone is black, then you have the stigma of, now black folks are protesting black folks, you should never do that. Especially in Georgia, where there's like 13 black colleges, large and small. So a predominantly white institution, because white institutions need money and they can't have people of color protesting every 5 minutes, it's easier to discuss race with them because they want money. And it's all about getting that money. It's all about development. So if you have an elder, and also I would like to say, although the institution educational base is of European standards and based in a certain systematic inequality, your education comes 80% from yourself and 20% from the institution. The goal of the institution is to teach you to hustle. So if you have books about African Americans, then I would create a study group that will teach you cognitive thinking and creative thinking outside of your classroom. That's where you invest in the education taught to you by the BSU or Black fraternities and sororities. Ask them to create programs that will help you develop a longer and wider angle of vision when you're doing things, and to have critical discussions about what do we do about this specific situation on the campus. Now, I used to be, you know, back in my, I've been protesting since the 11th grade. And I will pretend to be 25, although it is not true. So I've been protesting a long time. I've marched across bridges. I've done mediation. I am now in an alumni association in which we have had to negotiate with students who are on hunger strike to preserve the College of Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State. So I've been on, and now I'm working with faculty and staff in an institution. So I'm on every side, and now I advise students on how to effectively process what they want. On predominantly white institutions, it's easier because you can find one person who's been waiting for students to do something. And something could even mean just going to their office during office hours and talking to them about the inequities in the educational system, the inequities in the university police departments, the inequities in the housing rules. There are things, you know, the need for the creation of a black space on campus. These things, and it's not just a California thing, although it's way easier in California, I do admit, because everybody's scared of black folks for no reason in California. But this can happen, and like I said, there are over 85 campuses. Most of them are not HBCUs, with lists of demands that are being filtered through the African Black Coalition group, which is a group of college students that teach African Black liberation and social justice, and has been established since 2003.
So Monica, I just want to commend you on how you handled that particular question. It's good, and they get hotter and hotter because I think we touched a vein here. Do you know that Selena is 18 years old? And the first thing she says is she says, "Hey, Monica, I feel like," this is what she says. She said, "I feel like you need to be a policy expert, and these young people aren't experts, so they can't play out the policies in the classroom since they're not experts. So how do we best help them on making those strides?"
Well, you just need, okay, so generally in, like, most systems, there's always one guy who likes to read policy. I would get that guy. Because everybody doesn't have to know policy. You just need to know one guy who will read it and dissect it. In every student group, there's always the guy or girl who loves all that information. It's like your own computer. And also, you don't really need to know policies. You just need to know how whatever is happening affects you and the people that look like you. So what will happen is you bring up things like my friends get stopped in the front of the dorm, but other people's friends don't get stopped. Then you go to the dorm director and you say, "Do you know why this is?" And then they'll tell you the policy. You don't have to be a policy expert. You just need to know what the policy kind of is and see what happens to people like you when this policy is enacted. So if there, you know, and there's also, you know, for like the police department on universities, you can be on the police board. They need two students on the police, at least two students on the police board as a whole. And it's a review board. And if you don't have that, that's what you fight for. And then when they ask for that, you get the people who like information and have those people be on those boards. So everybody doesn't have to be a policy expert because everybody needs to play their position. There are going to be people in the street. There are going to be people at the student government meetings. There are going to be people who read up on policy and then tell everybody else what to say. That's how this movement works. The movement works because everybody plays their position, not because everybody knows one thing. I hope that was
like
helpful.
A strategy.
Can I jump?
Yeah, Blake, come on in. Come on in.
I have been listening to the discussion. There was some talk previously about generational differences. I would really encourage the younger generation to look to the older folks. I'm 64, and whereas today it's Black Lives Matter, when I was in college it was the Black Panther Party, it was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. There were a lot of organizations where members of that time still hold on to the same passion, okay, that they held 40 and 50 years ago. Those people are often ready to provide insight, direction. They can help with policy. They can help with how do we go about in change and avoiding some of the pitfalls that may have occurred years back. So those generational differences can be the best opportunity for an improved solution today.
That's totally true, especially because they know how the policy started. So we know as African Americans that gun control in California was started when the Black Panthers came to Sacramento with rifles.
Right.
And it was, so we know that. So because our elders know that and many are still here, so here's the thing. You have to listen to not only the ones that applaud you, you have to listen to the ones that critique, because they know the old school way, the pre-technology way of handling challenges. Now, I'm going to put this out there. If you want to get my email address, you can email me with questions. You can get it on, we can put it in somewhere and we can find that. We can also try to find you, you can go to the African Black Coalition, African spelled with a K, AfricanBlackCoalition.com. Those people have resources everywhere. Also, check your libraries, because elders are in libraries all the time and they would love to speak with you. Volunteer with elders. Volunteer with elders at your church. Volunteer with elders at the older Black members of university staff and faculty. Just have lunch. Just talk with them. They are so filled with information, you will find a whole new strategy and not even be looking for it.
And are willing to participate.
Yeah, I want to jump in here because I can't get this one through. There's so many coming in. This is Annalisa. Thank you so much, everyone. They're coming through the AALP messaging. I also fired up our old Yahoo account because we've had people who have followed the program for almost 6 years now. Blake, this one is specifically for you. It's from a gentleman, Chase. He is also from Virginia. He said, Blake, really appreciate what you just said. Can you please provide, from your perspective, what are some of the gaps or what are some of the things we're missing in this movement that you saw during the Black Panther movement that made a lot of what they did successful? If you could just comment a little bit on that.
Great question.
That's an outstanding question. And what I'm seeing now isn't necessarily just what we're doing that might be ineffective. It's also the pushback that I'm seeing from white Americans. Many of them have grown tired of race issues, and they just want them to go away. We have to really create dialogue, and that dialogue must be across lines. It cannot be just Black folks talking amongst Black folks. Has to extend to those people that are considered, quote-unquote, the oppressors. I do a lot of that in my current capacity, where I try to create dialogue. I try to create understanding. In the old days, we spoke about having empathy, not just sympathy. You have to feel what the other person feels. And through that, you start to gain a better understanding on both sides of the issue. In spite of the words that we hear, there's a tremendous lack of understanding. Why are we angry? Well, we're angry because the same things that happened 50 years ago are still happening. But we have to be able to show them and explain to them, and more importantly, have them feel the impact of the things that are happening to us today that are creating anger.
Beautiful done. Well done, Rick. I appreciate you, your sharing. And Annalisa, thank you for bringing that particular question to the table at that particular time. It was perfect. Monica, you've had a chance to take a breath now, and so what else you got to add?
Well, I just want to say that in regard to, because we were supposed to talk about the diversity, the new diversity of HBCUs, and in research, it shows that HBCUs are now up to 11% African American, 11% white, who are considered white. And there's a lot of Latino, Filipino, Pacific Islander population. However, just like when, you know, white people join black organizations, you have to understand the goal of the campus. So the goal of the campus is still the enrichment, empowerment of the oppressed class, or the underrepresented. So when you go to a historically black college, it's just like when you're a non-black person joining a historically black organization. You have to understand that a lot of this stuff happening is not for you. So a lot of people already come in with that understanding. A lot of the young people now have understood the oppression because they're a generation that are genuinely raised with other black people around them. So they see that police pull up and only their friend is on the ground. They see these things happening. So people who generally go to, unless they're from another country, if they're American white, they know what's happening, and they really want to do things as a sense of service to the community as a whole. So although there are some protests at historically black colleges, there aren't as many because ultimately there's the deference that we give to elders, the deference that we give to elder blacks that affects a lot of protests. And also they list, you know, a lot of the problems that we have are not the same, so they don't get grouped into the Black Lives Matter category, although some may. You know, at Howard University, they have an elementary school there that was forbidden to teach Black History Month. I mean, there's some things that probably should be talked about that we don't talk about. So I don't know if that answers. Yeah, that was fun. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then, so what do you do with that, and who do you go? It's Howard. What do you do when the Howard University does not want to teach Black Studies to the students at the adjacent high school that's on their campus?
That's a topic in itself.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So, wow. That kind of took the wind out of my sails there for a minute because I hadn't heard of that particular. I hadn't heard of that particular one. But you're right. We do have to find. We've got a lot of people though nowadays, Monica, that we find that are multiracial, multicultural, and so while they may look like a particular ethnicity, they may have ties and connection and roots, if you will, in the African American community also.
Right.
So I think that those are some of the things that we might want to take in consideration when it comes to the change in demographic as well.
Right.
I think that I know some people, for example, who want to go to HBCU. Their mom or dad may be, European. And so some of the stuff they may not even remotely know. So it's an opportunity for them to get in touch with themselves. We know, and many times we have a tendency to find ways to separate ourselves and as opposed to embracing who we are as a whole. And so I think maybe this Black Lives Matter gives us an opportunity as well to see that all lives, while we say all lives matter, we don't want to dismiss anything, but there are pieces of the puzzle that we may not be able to see with our naked eye.
So, like I said last, Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then also, first of all, if you're white and you want to go to a black college, I would visit first because some are more friendly than others. Let's put that as a precept.
Okay.
But you should do that with any college. But in general, like, you should, you know, just like if you're a person who is not black and you would like to join a black organization, you may want to check with them because that may not be the best thing for you. So, but one of the things that, and, you know, and I understand the concept of all lives matter, but if black lives don't matter, all lives won't matter, you know, that's the general thing. But, and we also need to understand the closer you are to black, regardless of ethnicity, you still have these problems. So the Black Lives Matter movement in Australia is not African Americans. It's not even Africans. It's Aboriginal Australians that are being given the same treatment as black Americans are here. You know, Black Lives Matter in Germany or Paris are not African Americans. They are people from the continent that have immigrated to those countries. And, you know, there's a problem with the concept of dark skin in a lot of cultures. So a lot of these things, and then we must understand that only 35% of the people who are being shot by police this year, they're black. The rest of them are Native Americans. The rest of them are Latino Americans. A lot of them are people with special disabilities or different learning or different, you know, engagement abilities. So we have to understand that, you know, people of color are catching it everywhere. You know, they're skin bleaching everywhere because people don't want the trouble to be someone who's considered black. You know, there was something on social media this week where Bow Wow, the rapper, was like, I don't do anything about politics because I'm mixed, because my daddy's Indian, so I don't have to worry about this Black Lives Matter stuff.
Okay.
And folks were like, if you don't shut your black self up,
well,
you know what I mean?
Okay.
because everybody has this problem. Because when you're black, no matter what your black looks like, if you're an indigenous Filipino, indigenous Pacific Islander, you know, anything that looks closer to black than white, you have a problem with some type of race-based microaggression problem in this here United States.
Wow. Yeah, you make an interesting point there. We're running out of time, and I want to get this question in from Natasha, who's 20 years old. And she's a student at an HBCU, and she says, the reason I decided to attend an HBCU is because I wanted to be around my people and my culture. I also feel like they are suppressing the dialogue around the killing of our black men of color. How do we bring our white students around us? And Natasha's question, I think, is a good one in that, while they're at HBCU and they are with our people and with our culture, there needs to be some community, if you will, that embraces white students to come around, and so it's not an isolated incident.
You're at a black college, so they have to come to you because they're in your space. You're not in theirs. So a lot of your problems may be the administration creating a narrative that your points aren't valid. Some white students, and it could be, and you also have to check to see the nationality, not the ethnicity of the white students you have. There are foreign students that don't have any idea what's happening because they don't have, you know, a lot of countries don't have black people. You know, and they come to HBCUs because they get a discount, and then they bring their friends. So there's that. I think that HBCUs are in a special position in that white people are uneasy because this is the first time they're the other. And a lot of people, you know, they're the other. They've never had to be other before. They've never had to be the only one in chemistry class. That's what we've been doing for 20 years. That now they're coming, and now they are the one person. So, yes, we can bring them around. But, again, I say, this is the only system that is built for us. If you come, you should probably bring yourself around and not worry about white folks or people who are privileged coming into your space because it is your space. So they need to come around because of the space they are in, and maybe they're not in the right college, which is horrible to say, but we don't get to be the majority often. So us still worrying about them is a challenge.
You know, you bring up an interesting point there when you say that I don't know how to put this, but that the roles are reversed. And so I think you're spot on there. All right, here we go. We're coming to the end, Monica, and I just want to share this particular statement from Jason. Yeah, we may have to just expand this stuff. This is his, you know Jason. So Jason says, there's Jason. Jason says, hi. Hi, you guys, how you doing? Remember me? I was homeless, logged into your show. Yeah, I do remember. And that was the beginning of my changing life. I was so happy to hear you back on the air. This program really impacted and changed my life. Gosh.
Oh, my gosh.
You all know
Jason.
How.
Jason of San Jose.
Jason,
yes.
Says, thank you. Please continue attacking the issues and add a session on colorism, skin bleaching. And then Jason ends it by saying, love you. Gosh, Jason,
aww.
Good to hear from you.
I know.
What's up, Jason? So, Jason, before we do that, because I did do my senior project on the color complex and its effects on American South and Western states. Hello.
Oh.
Holla at a scholar. There's a book called The Color Complex, and the author is Kathy Russell. So we can talk about doing this episode, and I will talk with my boss Annalisa about that. Hey, Annalisa, can we do that? Before we get that, it is the book is called The Color Complex, and the author is Kathy Russell. And that's a great place to start, and then we can talk about it because I got 3 copies at the house. And we can have a discussion about that if my boss, Annalisa, please let us do it. Let me.
Sure, Monica.
No pressure.
No pressure. No pressure. No pressure. Beautiful.
Excellent. So, hey, listen, everyone, thank you so much for joining the National Conversation. I have to tell you this, Jason, thank you, member, as a matter of fact, and congratulations on everything you've been able to do. We also have another gentleman whose life was dramatically impacted by the speakers that we had on the show and changed their lives around. So this is why we do this, right? This is why we take a lesson. This is why we share the story. This is why we ask Monica and Ed and Blake and I to just kind of share what we've learned. And so with that, we want to thank you for joining us. Please join us next week where Blake's going to be moderating the session on corporate America. There's a number of people who've already got some questions that are lined up for him. Just so that you know, this is just one of, you know, our series on the national conversation. This one was moderated by Ed Harris. Thank you so much. This will be available immediately on the Blog Talk Radio /Altruistic Leadership page. Please share this conversation with your friends. And so on behalf of myself, Annalisa, Ed Harris, Monica Brooks, thank you, Monica and Nick. Thank you for tuning in to Take a Lesson. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.